Okay, this is a recording for the Hidden Histories Project. I'm Anne Welsh and I'm speaking to John Unsworth on the 21st of June 2011. As we've already explained, we've gone through the data consent form with you, and as we've already explained, this is just a nice gentle intro to your career and life in what we now know as digital humanities. So it's a nice easy question which you can interpret however you would like, which is just really, could you tell us a little bit about how you first got involved in what we now think of as digital humanities, and I guess what was then computing in the humanities?
So the sort of first step in that direction was not really intentional. I was a new faculty member at North Carolina State University, and I'd been hired there to teach post-World War II American literature, and there weren't really many journals, academic journals, in that area. There was just one, actually, called Boundary 2, and so with a couple of friends, one who's a friend from graduate school who also ended up on the same faculty a year later, we decided to start a journal in that area. And NC State was in a budget crisis, as public higher education always is, as far as I can tell. So there was no money for printing, and there was no money for mailing. So we consulted with the university librarian, a woman named Susan Nutter, who I think is still head of the libraries at NC State. And she introduced us to people in the campus computing organization, who introduced us to some brand new software that had just come out called Listserv. This was in 1990, and actually probably 89. And so we put together the first issue. We circulated on email lists and bulletin boards and stuff information about the journal and solicited contributions, and actually went out and recruited a bunch of contributions from people who had nothing to lose professionally by publishing in a new journal in a new medium, and had quite a good lineup in the first issue, and there was no markup. We could have distributed files in a word processing format, but we wanted to have them be broadly accessible, so we didn't want to limit our audience to people who used a certain kind of hardware or software. So we just distributed the articles in plain text, one article per message. We were actually very doctrinaire about formatting, though. We maintained a 65 character line, because 65 characters in Courier, 10 point, you could print out on an 8.5 by 11 page, and the lines would break correctly. And we had two spaces after every period, so you could distinguish between sentences and ellipses, which only had one period, one space, and so on. And our big innovation was we numbered paragraphs, actually, because we wanted people to be able to cite this, but there wouldn't be page numbers, or the page numbers wouldn't necessarily be consistent. So we mailed it. We mailed the first issue out, all, 10 articles, and we had a popular culture column, and we had some, I think we even had some ad exchanges with print journals. And pretty much that crashed everybody's mailbox who got the first issue of the journal, because nobody had any capacity at all in their mailbox and to get, like a journal's worth of text, even though it was just plain text, made, their mailboxes were essentially inaccessible to them until they contacted their campus computing people and said, "Help, my journal has crashed my mailbox." So after that, we just sent out the table of contents with instructions for people to how to retrieve articles from Listserv. And then later, when FTP came along, we put it up for FTP, and when Gopher came along and gave you a menu for FTP, we put it up on Gopher, and when the web came along, we put the back issues up on the web, and I think our first issue that was designed for the web was in January 1994, and it actually proved to be very useful that we had been doctrinaire about formatting, because we could write shell scripts to go back and mark up the back issues. So that was a good thing. So I didn't mean to get into electronic publishing. It was sort of fiscal necessity. And also being at a technical university where there were people around who were interested in this kind of experimentation. But it was Postmodern Culture, still published by Johns Hopkins University Press. It's in its 22nd year now, I think, currently edited by my brother-in-law. And it was the first peer-reviewed electronic journal in the humanities.
Wow. That's amazing. And how much technical knowledge did you have yourself at the point where you were starting off?
Not that much. Certainly no formal training. Most of my technical knowledge came from procrastinating in the course of writing my dissertation. So I wrote it on a word processor. Sanyo CPM machine with WordStar.
I remember WordStar.
I learned a little bit of BASIC. I would go in and edit the compiled code to change the messages on my splash screen. Things like that. I mean,
yeah.
We were talking about ways to waste time instead of writing your dissertation.
Yeah, that sounds entirely sensible really to me.
But I had started using email as a graduate student at Virginia, and you know there weren't a lot of people to exchange email with, but that was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. And culturally, I mean, what you're saying really chimes in. I can remember email coming in and just how amazing it was. But culturally, you know, did you feel that you were kind of ahead of a curve, or were you just really focused on getting this product out, or what was the kind of attitude to the whole computer side of things? Can you remember how you felt about it? Was it kind of, oh, this is really exciting, or?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, and you know, it was pretty clearly against the advice that any sensible senior person would have given me, and me beginning with editing the journal as a junior faculty member, because that's service, you know, not research. And, you know, putting your time into editing a journal that didn't get printed. And I actually had senior faculty at NC State at one point. This guy took me aside and told me, I won't name any name, told me it was inappropriate for a junior faculty member to be running a peer review process in which we pass judgment on our seniors in the profession. So
completely different culture.
I said, thank you very much for that perspective. But yeah, we were convinced that for financial reasons, that sort of all academic journal publishing would quickly follow suit. And 5 years on the outside, all academic journals were going to be electronic.
Yeah, that was the year of the paperless office, wasn't it? Everything was going to be electronic. So in terms of kind of meeting other people, because you said that on your campus, because it was very tech-focused, you'd met a lot of people who were good technically. So in terms of meeting other people, so maybe off campus, who were using computing in the humanities, do you remember your first encounters of that kind?
Well, mostly in that period from 90 to about 93 when I was at NC State. Most of the people that I was meeting were in conferences organized by libraries mm-hmm. and focused on electronic journals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was reading things in Humanist also, but, you know, the people that I was meeting at conferences were pretty much other people involved in doing electronic journals in an academic context, and that was a very small and heterogeneous group of people. We had a guy who had a journal in hospitality research. There was Paul Ginspark from the High Energy Physics ArchiveX project, who still works on that. Stephen Harnad was at some of these conferences. I mean, people from completely different disciplinary backgrounds who, you know, the only thing they had in common was that they were trying to do electronic mm-hmm. publishing, electronic scholarly publishing. Yeah. And they had very different ideas about, you know, what was the best business model, and, you know, should you charge for it, should it be free. Mm-hmm. Remember, the guy from the hospitality research thing was adamantly opposed to what we didn't then call open access, but, you know, publishing things for free. It's like, people only value what they pay for. You got to charge for it.
Yeah. Old school. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we've noticed as younger scholars in the field is that when people talk about that particular era, it seems like this kind of heterogeneity seemed to be a lot more prevalent, and the kind of, sort of past papers for conferences recently, there seems to be a move towards trying to open up and become more heterogeneous, but we're not sure whether that observation on our part is myopic and restricted to just standing where we are and looking back at something we don't know. So I don't know, how do you feel about the field and how it's, with regard to that, how it's developed? This idea of kind of the randomness, I guess, brought together by the need for a particular technology that you were just describing.
Yeah, I think you still see that around, you know, sort of emerging technologies. So people will pick up some new technology, and people who have very different disciplinary backgrounds, if you look at in the poster session what people were doing with text mining now, you know, these people would never meet at any other conference mm-hmm. Because the content that they're working with is extremely different. But they meet here because there's a shared interest in the method. And you know, and I think the digital humanities community as a whole goes through, you know, sort of phases of kind of consolidation and diversification. So sort of not, you're not circling, more like a spiral staircase. You know, you pass the same point but at different levels over time, so the community gets bigger. And you know, yet there are moments when it seems, you know, more homogenous, and then there are other moments where it seems to be opening up. Mm-hmm. One of the problems that we have right now is that there's more, we have a conference format that can't accommodate all of the interest that people have in participating, so there's a lot of pressure right now to open things up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. It's a sort of cyclical thing. It's a perspective that you can only have when you've been in any field for a long time, really. Mm. It's quite interesting. What else? Well, yeah, so one thing that I'm interested, or that we're both interested in, really, is the other people who were around at the time. And in terms of kind of your own research, who you would look back to or look up to and think, yeah, I want to adopt their methods, or has everything that you've done been kind of along the same model that you mentioned? You had something you wanted to do, you found a tool that could do it, and developed your career along that way.
Well, in 93, I moved from North Carolina State to the University of Virginia, and that was a much broader job. I was also in the English department and on the tenure track, so I had 4 years in rank at that point at NC State, but I got hired to direct the Institute for Advanced Technology in the Humanities at Virginia, much to their surprise, I have to say. I don't think they meant to hire me. Everybody else pissed somebody off, and I was the last one standing, so they said, well, give that one a try. And there, you know, I worked with Jerry McGann, I worked with Ed Ayers, I worked with Thorny Staples, who now, you know, works for the Fedora Commons Duraspace group. I worked with a bunch of, you know, faculty at Virginia and at other places who were, you know, early adopters. The people from the Whitman Archive who were here. That project started at the Institute. The Blake Archive project started at the Institute. Jerry's Rossetti Archive. The Whitman, the Emily Dickinson project that Martha Nell Smith runs, and Myth actually, it was a sort of spin-off in some ways of the Institute, as was the center at Nebraska, and worked with a lot of great students. Matt Kirschenbaum was a PhD advisee. Steve Ramsey was a student in the English department and an employee at the Institute when he was a graduate student. Amanda French was there. Tons of, you know, there's a real sort of Virginia diaspora from that place and that moment where you can trace people who are now all over the field who, you know, were there as faculty fellows or were there as graduate students. And so that was a real opening up in terms of, you know, projects and topics and disciplines and methods and for me, it was great. I mean, my interests are in scholarly communication, ultimately. So that was, you know, that was the best lab you can imagine. Seeing all these people who, you know, many of whom have a long history doing book scholarship, figuring out how to sort of reinvent that in an electronic form. A lot of the projects were electronic textual editing projects. I ended up, for a chunk of that time, I was chair of the Modern Language Association's Committee on Scholarly Editions, and we produced a book that they still sell called Electronic Textual Editing, which was going to bring the kind of principles of scholarly editing that the CSE represented together with text encoding principles from the TEI to give people fairly practical guidance actually about how to do electronic scholarly editing. We redid the guidelines for the CSE so that they would be able to review electronic editions, which they did. They reviewed the Blake Archive and gave it high marks. So there was just, you know, from 94 to 2004 when I was at Virginia, that was a real opening up into a much broader world of people. That's when I started coming to this conference, actually, in 94. It was my first in Paris. So that, you know, it's when I took that job and a broader horizon opened up, that's when I really became involved in this community.
Mm-hmm. And how did you find the community when you first encountered it? Because going to any new conference can be quite daunting. So how did you find it when you arrived and onto this kind of international scene?
It was, you know, it was a small conference. It was pretty friendly, but there was also the sense that, you know, there were a lot of people here who knew each other quite well and, you know, had sort of established value system that wasn't necessarily obvious. So, you know, some of the early experience was, you know, I'm not sure if I just stepped in something. Maybe I did. So there was a little bit of that, which is inevitable, I think. But it certainly wasn't an unfriendly place. The first conference was a little weird. It was half in French and half in English, and it was strictly segregated. You know, there were the French sessions and the sessions in English. We had brought... we had just set up a web server, which was a big deal in 1994. We set it up for these projects that we were going to do in Virginia. And it was a sort of decision. When I got there, actually, they thought they were going to build the scholars workbench. And I had been working with the web at NC State a little bit before coming to Virginia, and I said, no, the point is communication, and, you know, a hermetically sealed software environment is not, you know, no matter how good it is not what you want. People, scholars, want to communicate with each other, and the way they're going to do that is through the web, so we should, you know, put our efforts on, you know, finding durable ways to do things, because the web's going to change, you know, really quickly, but we need to translate things to the web, and that needs to be the medium of distribution. So we'd set up a web server. We had a Unix laptop, an IBM Unix laptop, which probably weighed about 35 pounds, I don't know. And it had like it probably wasn't even a 1 gig drive, it was probably 500 megabytes, but it was huge. And it ran all the software for the website right on there. So you could just address the website, you know, from localhost. And we kept communicating with the people at the Sorbonne, you know, we want to bring this over, we want to do a demo as part of our session and show the website. You know, does the Sorbonne have, we didn't actually start with the laptop idea. The first question was, does the Sorbonne have a network jack? Like, can we get on a network and show this at home? And the guy at the other end would write back and say, the Sorbonne, she's an old lady. Right back and say, does the old lady have a network jack? And eventually it became clear that the old lady did not have a network jack. So we put together this laptop and said, okay, we want an overhead projector. Can we get an overhead projector? And I said, yes, you can get an overhead projector. So we lugged this thing through airport security. You know, they were very interested to like take the external hard drive apart and show them that it wasn't a bomb. We got it all the way to Paris, set it up in the room, and out comes, we had an LCD panel, remember those?
Yeah, I remember.
We just put on an overhead projector.
Yeah.
And it was just like a see-through LCD screen. Right. And it would display, you know, it was before they had data projectors. So
it was
an LCD panel that sat on an overhead projector. The light shines through, and then you get an image on, you know, through the overhead projector of what was going on the screen. So this is what we had, and they brought out their overhead projector, and it was an opaque projector, which is completely useless from this point of view, because an opaque projector just bounces the light down and back up off the thing. It doesn't project through the bottom. So opaque projectors are what you use if you have a piece of paper and you want to write on it and have people see what you write. It's not oriented for transparencies. So we looked at that, we like put everything away, got the marker out, you know, went to the whiteboard and said, see, this is what a web server is like. And started drawing things. So the whole conference experience was a little strange. But it was Paris.
Yeah.
No, and I do think part of the appeal of this conference is that it happens in interesting places, and so I clued into that pretty early. It took me a while to understand the importance of the social program at this conference. You should always attend. I've been every year since going. I've posted it twice.
And thinking outside academia, can you tell us a little bit about how you think the general public perceived the computer in the era that you were working in? because you're kind of moving from the 80s right through to the mid 90s in the projects that you've been talking about today. So was there any kind of perception there? And it's really the era of the birth of the web, isn't it?
Right. I mean, the computer was a sort of specialized piece of office or research equipment for, you know, the early part of that time. It's not that, you know, it wasn't that uncommon. I mean, the computer that I had was a hand-me-down from my dad. And I also had another hand-me-down of his, was a little TRS-80, you know, kept its data on a cassette recorder and run basic programs. So, you know, people had these things, but they were usually only, you know, people in sort of academic or business settings who would think of having them at home, really, you know, because they had them at work. And it was the web in 94, really, is when people started talking about the web in the New York Times, and, you know, suddenly and very rapidly became something that was for everybody. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge game changer for academic computing, because, I mean, we would never have had the same impact on our colleagues as that did, because that, you know, that swept up everybody. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, because of the information resources that it presented were so large and so varied, not right away, but even at the beginning they were various enough to be interesting. But the scale was really different at the beginning. I think when the first graphical web browsers came out, when Mosaic first came out, it had a What's Cool list built into it. It was like a bookmarks list that was built into it, and postmodern culture was on that list.
Yay.
Because there were so few cool things that that we were one of them.
I'm sure you're doing yourself a great disservice here.
No. I'm being quite realistic.
But in terms of, I mean, coming back to what you initially said about distributing through a listserv and how that made it more available, I mean, I guess that opens up the whole question about email and, you know, what the state of play was with email in that period, and, you know, how many people actually had an email account.
Oh, by the mid-90s, I most people on university campuses had email, and at least in, you know, the universities that I dealt with. But it was not really until the web swept everybody up that, you know, it was common to have, you know, for your grandmother to have an email account. But people had email at home. I mean, people had AOL, God save them. People had, and there were bulletin boards and, you know, chat rooms and other kinds of things. I belonged to one of the first network discussion groups that I found was on, was called Tattoo, and it was on body modification. And I subscribed to it because it was like the only thing out there. And so it's like, I want to see how this works.
It's a methodological study. That's
right.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So I learned a lot about body modification and discussion groups.
Yeah.
And they were very active.
But it must have been a very different environment. I mean, nowadays we talk an awful lot, don't we, on campuses about public engagement and the independent scholar and, you know, the scholar outside the walls of the campus. And, you know, back then, the electronic thing was quite gated in a way.
Well, the universities ran it.
Yeah.
And it didn't, you know, it wasn't privatized until the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So it really was, initially a military and research network, then an academic network, mm-hmm. and then a public network.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Huge change to have lived through, really.
I remember BitNet.
Yeah. I think that's really good as a first interview.
Yeah.
Looking over at Julianne to make sure She's happy with everything that we've covered, and just really, you know, fantastic. I'm going to thank you ever so much, and shut the recording down at that point.